From KUER.
This is Radio West.
I'm Doug Fabrizio. In a piece for The New Yorker magazine, the writer Adam Gopnik explores early Mormon history. After Joseph Smith was killed, the story might have ended, but he writes that as a rule, the success of a religious movement depends not so much on the success of the mystical visions of its founder as on the executive energy of its first evangelist. Brigham Young played that role for the Mormons. Gopnik calls John Turner's new biography of Brigham Young definitive, and today in the program, Turner is joining us to talk about it. He explains how Brigham Young gathered the saints and held them together through exile and persecution. He explains how Young was blunt and pugnacious, but also full of fervent energy and always loyal. We invite you to join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his biography of Mormon leader Brigham Young, John Turner explains that sometime after his conversion to the faith, Young went all in. In fact, he called it his all in all. Young had said it was difficult to take hold of Mormonism, and Turner says the same can be said of Brigham Young. In his book, he explores what he calls Young's incredibly complicated persona and personality. A man who spoke in tongues and gave powerful, fervent prayers, but who could also be pugnacious and profane. A man who believed in seer stones and witches, but also embraced telegraphs and railroads. Turner says Brigham Young was transformed by the murder of Joseph Smith, changed his personality, but also his approach to leadership. Young didn't tolerate dissent, and he ruled with an iron fist, but he was also a fierce protector of his people. And when they had been persecuted and exiled, he took hold of them, and in some way, just by force of sheer will, he led them to their place in the American West. Today in the program, John Turner is joining us to talk about his book. It's called Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet. John Turner is an assistant professor of religious studies at George Mason University. He's also written about the American evangelical movement, and he's joining us today from WGMU on the campus of George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. And John Turner, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. It's great to be with you and your listeners.
I want to start with, I guess, an obvious question of why another book about Brigham Young? Because you point out in your book that there have been some impressive books, but it seems like, at least from your perspective, they all seem to lack something. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think that's fair to say. That's definitely what I thought. First of all, I mean, Brigham Young is this towering figure in Utah history and in Mormon history, but there hadn't been a fresh biography about Brigham Young for more than a quarter century, which is a long time in, you know, terms of publishing. I found that there was a lot of new scholarship and sources that I could draw on, and that would help me get a little bit closer to Brigham Young than previous biographers.
Your first academic religious studies focused on evangelicals in the United States, which you've said was sort of a way to kind of better understand your own religious heritage. You had some experience with the evangelical culture when you were younger. But mm-hmm. at some point you say you sort of you shifted to studying Mormonism, and particularly Mormonism in the 19th century. And I wanted to ask why. What was it about Mormonism and Mormonism of that era that really interested you?
Well, I think if you're interested in the history of religion in the United States, it's hard not to at least be a little bit curious about the success of the Latter-day Saints. Yeah. There are all sorts of religious prophets and new movements in the northeastern United States of the early 1800s, but only Mormonism ultimately grew to be a movement of national and global significance. So I wanted to understand that. And I had grown up outside of Rochester, New York, so not too far from Palmyra and where all of this began. So I had this sort of latent curiosity about the Mormons. And as I started reading about Mormon history and expanding my knowledge, I found Brigham Young to be this, you know, pivotal and towering figure, not just for the success of Mormonism, but for the story of westward expansion and American politics in the mid-19th century.
We should point out you're not yourself Mormon. And there was this recent New York Times article that mentioned you as one of the examples of what seems to be this growing list of non-Mormons who are entering the field of study of Mormonism. Are you noticing that? Why do you figure that is?
It's a little bit hard to explain, why that would be happening now. I think, for many years, scholars of religion in America were focused on Protestantism, which until recently was a majority of the American population, and then secondly on Catholicism, which for a long time has been about a fifth or a quarter of the U.S. population. I think it was harder in earlier decades to make a case for studying a group that amounts to 1.5 or 2% of the American population. But I think today, with the expansion of religious pluralism and diversity in the country, studying groups that used to be seen as on the margins is much more acceptable. Mm.
One thing that is important to say, and you point this out in the book, that Brigham Young was a man of the 19th century. And as you say in the book, people should avoid, as you say, any tortured attempt to make him palatable for a 21st century audience. This is part of what the book's about, putting him in context of his time.
Yes, an attempt to better understand him. I think if you look at his opinions about race or women or violence, there are things that almost all early 21st century people are going to find repugnant. And I'm not saying that people shouldn't find those sorts of viewpoints repugnant,
sure,
but they shouldn't be surprising for a white man in the mid-1800s.
You say in the book that this is not – you don't make any appraisals about contemporary Mormonism. But I wanted to ask about your sense of the reaction from Mormons so far, the Mormon community. I wanted to ask you in particular about a review of the book in a Mormon blog I found called Times and Seasons. Mm-hmm. A woman by the name of Julie Smith, she wrote this piece, and she says that she had, quote, serious reservations about recommending your book to the average church member. She loved the book, I should point out, though. But she writes this. She says, if you need your prophet to be larger than life, then this book is not for you. She says there's a substantial risk, in fact, that members who have fairly sanitized or romantic images of their prophets would have, as she puts it, their testimonies rocked, if not shattered, by this book. What do you make of that reaction?
Well, coming from a Protestant background, that's hard to understand on some level. Obviously, the way that, say, a Presbyterian would view the leaders of his church is going to be very different than the way a Latter-day Saint might view his or her prophets.
Yeah.
And so, I'm coming from a different perspective. I would say that, if you're going in with the expectation that prophets should always act with perfect character and wisdom, then certainly the material in this book could be challenging. But I would also suggest that, anyone familiar with, say, that the stories of prophets and patriarchs in the Jewish Bible in the Old Testament should recognize that all religious leaders have human frailties. Mm. And I don't think that ultimately belief or faith should hinge on grappling with those frailties.
The LDS scholar Richard Bushman wrote this acclaimed biography of Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling, people may know about. He wrote a blurb for your book, and in it he says, while the book lauds Brigham Young's achievements, it will, here's how he puts it, require a reassessment of Brigham Young, the man. Do you think that's true? That Mormons are going to have, that if they read this book and see some of the warts of his character, which are not alone, you talk about the good parts as well, but do you think that's going to require them to sort of rethink who this man was?
I suppose it depends on their prior conceptions of Brigham Young.
Yeah.
My sense from spending time with folks in Utah is that most people are aware that Brigham Young had his rough spots.
Sure.
So, I think some people are already aware of that. But yeah, I the purpose of my book was not to judge Brigham Young's character.
Yeah.
It was to seek to understand him. And a lot of his frailties I see as very much a product of his experiences and struggles during his years as a Latter-day Saint, especially the trauma of Joseph Smith's murder and the forced expulsion from Nauvoo. So, you know, Brigham Young's approach to leadership and the things that he does and says that are more difficult to stomach, perhaps, I think they're also a reflection of the experiences that, shaped him.
Mm. Well, let's start with a story. It's the first story in the book. It happens on New Year's Day, 1877, where about 1,300 Mormons have gathered in St. George. It's in the southern part of what is now Utah. And Young is speaking at this momentous occasion. The temple there, Mormon temple in St. George, is being dedicated. And you talk about how he begins to speak and how his tone changes. And this seems to be a really interesting reflection of the man Brigham Young had become as a leader. Talk about that story, if you would.
Well, first of all, Brigham Young is living with very advanced age at that point and a lot of frailties. He can't walk. He's brought into the St. George Temple on what was called a sedan chair with rollers. But then he, you know, this is a man who's given thousands of sermons over the past 45 years. And this momentous occasion, the dedication of the church's first temple since the temple in Nauvoo, Illinois, he's certainly not going to just let it pass him by. So he gets up and he speaks. And, you know, he starts off, you know, celebrating the accomplishment. And then you're quite right, his tone changes. And he's worried that his people will not dedicate themselves first and foremost to the sacred importance of temple work, that instead they're going to chase after riches. They're going to be concerned with mining. They're going to give the people's wealth away to the Gentiles, to non-Mormons. And, you know, he warns them that if they do that, they are destined for hell. And he whacks the pulpit of the temple with his cane to the point of leaving marks in it that were viewed many decades later. So it's this image of a fierce prophet who, until his last breath, is going to urge his people to fully embrace their religion.
I'm trying to put it in perspective, this kind of a sermon or this kind of a talk, in the context of the somewhat more subdued, polite speeches that you hear from Mormon leaders of today. Because Brigham Young at the time, he says too many of the Mormon people were, quote, damned fools. Mm-hmm. So he really let them have it.
Oh, he let him have it, and it wasn't incredibly unusual. I mean, he sometimes used language that I should not employ during this interview, Doug. And, you know, sometimes that would shock visitors from the East, and that was a common experience when Easterners came to the American West, not just to Utah. So there's a sense of the rough and tumble coarseness of the American frontier of this time in Brigham Young's speech and demeanor.
Mm. You write that in order to understand Brigham Young, we really have to kind of reckon with his self-understanding and his own religious outlook. So give us a kind of a bearing of where he begins. You talk about how his conversion to Mormonism really kind of marks this, I think rupture is the word you put, from his previous life, where he's a craftsman. He's a furniture maker who had come from parents who would struggle all of their lives to make a living. I guess not unlike Joseph Smith's experience.
Very much like Joseph Smith's experience. You know, they both came from families that moved from Vermont to Western New York and just never got ahead. There would be glimmers of economic hope and then dashed dreams. And Brigham Young was an economic drifter. He moved around a lot geographically, often from year to year, taking on a different sort of work. And he was also a spiritual seeker. He had something of an evangelical conversion to a branch of Methodism, and that didn't stick either. And it left him feeling despondent and very concerned both about his salvation and the state of Protestant churches. And then you're quite right when he, after a period of hesitation for a couple of years, after he converts to Mormonism and is baptized, that gives his life a clear direction and purpose from which he doesn't waver for his last 45 years.
You say there were a lot of stories of the supernatural in his family lore. Mm-hmm. This was, and I guess this was not uncommon for the time. I mean, there were, you know, beliefs in, you know, angelic visitations. Was this sort of typical, this kind of belief?
I think it was pretty typical. His family all joined a pretty radical group of Methodists in the 1820s, and there were reports of divine healing. There were some scattered reports of speaking in tongues. There were visions. Not all Americans were experiencing these things in the early 1800s, but there was a strata, especially, out on what wasn't quite the frontier anymore, but out in the hinterlands, where those sorts of religious experiences were very common. And I think they, in some senses, prepared him to accept the message of the Book of Mormon and Joseph Smith.
What was it like in his household? I get a sense it was a little grim. I mean, they had a pretty stringent moral code. There was no cursing, no dancing, no music, no drinking. They were pretty straight-laced.
They were pretty straight-laced. They were also very poor. But yes, there was that kind of strict Methodist moral code. And, you know, he later talks about Mormonism as being quite different, as being a religion where music is very important, where he's comfortable with at least certain forms of theater. And so in a sense, there's a cultural liberation that he later comes to understand through Mormonism. I don't think he necessarily thinks about that at the time of his conversion.
Because he ended up doing all of those things, cursing and dancing and playing music and drinking, all of those kinds. And it seems like there was a kind of rebellious streak in Brigham Young, or certainly the sense of independence, because you write about how when he was young, he refused to drink, but he also refused to sign what they called at the time a temperance pledge.
Right. Now, he didn't want to be bound. He very much treasured his independence. In terms of those sorts of decisions, and I think also his religious and spiritual independence. And so it is a big step for him to take to accept and embrace Joseph Smith as a prophet. But he takes that step despite his treasured independence, and it's that step that really changes his life.
You talk about how, really, when it came right down to it, as you say, he was going back and forth about whether he was going to do this. But you also mentioned that he converted because Mormonism satisfied this sense of skepticism that he had about – that was rooted, you say, in rationality but also in his sense of the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. But I think the experience that clinched it for him was when he saw a group of traveling Mormon elders speak in tongues. I mean, he'd been thinking about the Book of Mormon for almost 2 years. But when he saw this clear display of God's power, he took it as just that, you know, a sign of God's renewed presence in the world and a divine stamp of approval on this movement. And that seems to be what ultimately gets him over the hump. It's seeing those sorts of miracles, which is how he talks about them, that causes him to put those hesitations aside and be baptized.
What does he think of Joseph Smith at first?
He's very enthused after his first meeting with Joseph Smith, which takes place about 6 or 7 months after his conversion. He travels to Kirtland, Ohio, and he finds Joseph Smith chopping wood in a nearby forest. And I think he likes the fact that Joseph is this very down-to-earth figure who's not high and mighty or holier than thou, but somebody who's just out there chopping wood. And as you mentioned earlier, they came from rather similar backgrounds. I think they understood each other well. And he, from the start, accepts Joseph Smith as a prophet. He later talks about loving to hear Joseph explain doctrine. Brigham Young would say that he didn't necessarily understand everything that Joseph was saying at the time, but he treasured those opportunities, and then he later grew in his understanding.
Mm. And as you said earlier, and as I had mentioned in the introduction, he goes all in. Once he's committed, as you say, for the rest of his life, and as you say in the book, he has a hard time really – you can't distinguish Brigham Young from the faith. He wove his identity into it.
Absolutely. And you're quite right. He is fully committed from that point forward. And maybe that – you know, that might sound to some readers or listeners as a commonplace, but the first – 14 years or 16 years of the church's existence were extremely tumultuous. Yeah. And a lot of other top leaders in the church fell away and abandoned the faith. And many, a fair number, turned against Joseph Smith. And Brigham Young never does, which is one reason that he steadily rises in Joseph's estimation.
John G. Turner is with us. His book is called Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the historian John Turner is with us to talk about his biography of Brigham Young. It's called Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet. One of the things the book really does is makes this distinction between what seem to be these two parts of Brigham Young. The Brigham Young in the early days of the church when Joseph Smith is alive, and the sort of trauma that he goes through, as you mentioned, after Joseph Smith is killed and how that transforms him. Let's start with the first part of this, because you tell a story in the book when Brigham Young goes to England. He's almost 40 years old. He's been with the church something like 8 years. And there's the story that plays out in Manchester, England, where the saints there have gathered. And he's thinking about, as you tell it, kind of the manifestation of the Spirit, but he's also a little homesick. Talk about the Brigham Young in this at this time.
Well, I think he's a very winsome and collegial figure and leader. He is homesick. He has lots of dreams about his wife and children that he will write in his handwritten diary. And those I find are very precious sources. His spelling is terrible. Mm-hmm. His writing is somewhat difficult to read. But, you know, there it is, his words right on the page. And he'll have these dreams, and he'll write letters back to his only wife at the time, which are very witty and romantic. And he also gets along very easily with the other apostles who are with him on the mission in England. He doesn't seem to be trying to lead with a heavy hand or anything like that. And he's also deeply concerned about the spiritual lives of the new converts in England. In particular, he's concerned that many of them have not received the gifts of the Spirit, which primarily seem to be speaking in tongues. Mm. And there's a fascinating episode in which the saints in Manchester have a meeting one night, and there's one of the converts who Brigham Young later writes almost spoke in tongues, which I find fascinating. How could you almost speak in tongues?
Yeah.
And then Brigham Young speaks in tongues as if to show the people how to do it almost. And then the next night, a woman begins to speak in different languages, and I think sing in different languages as well in her sleep. And by Sunday, many people are having these experiences. And that this sounds very esoteric and strange, probably, to many Latter-day Saints today. But there is, you know, also a pastoral concern that, that Brigham Young is expressing through that sort of leadership.
I know this isn't about, the book isn't remotely about contemporary Mormonism, but it does make you wonder why Mormons don't speak in tongues anymore. You know, there was a speaking, Mormons were speaking in tongues all over the place in those earlier days. There was speaking in tongues at the dedication of the Kirtland Temple. And Brigham Young, I mean, this was a sign of God's power. This, as you said, this was the clincher for him in some ways to, for his conversion. And I guess the question that I was thinking about, would Brigham Young recognize modern Mormonism is the faith that he came to?
That's a great question. I think I'm sure many things would surprise him. You know, in terms of speaking in tongues, the last recorded instance of him speaking in tongues is it's either 1850 or 1851. So not long after he gets to Utah. You know, speaking in tongues is kind of a chaotic form of spirituality in the sense that it is, you know, ordinary church members expressing what are almost, you know, revelations from God, and then often somebody else would interpret them. And I think as the church matured, you know, Joseph Smith recognized that, that's it's a little bit hazardous to have people presenting those sorts of spiritual revelations with regularity. It might be better to have a little bit more order and a little bit less chaos. And I think Brigham Young ultimately came to think the same way. But I'm sure many things about the contemporary church would surprise Brigham Young. I think he'd be surprised at how well Mormons and non-Mormons get along for the very most part. He'd certainly, I think, would be surprised at the end of the priesthood ban on people of African descent holding the priesthood. So many things would surprise him.
Yeah. You know, so let's skip ahead. There's a lot of material in between all of this, and we can come back to some of these other elements. But let's skip ahead, as you have, to 1849. And you talk about how a lot has changed. There's this experience in February that you write about where he is admonishing some Mormon battalion veterans, and he is he's furious. And this is the Brigham Young who, as you describe, back in 1840 when he's in England, is a congenial sort of colleague and leader, gets along really well with people, a committed monogamist. You know, he has one wife. And you jump ahead, and he's taken the saints, the Mormon saints, to the West, gone through all of the persecution and the deprivation, and gone from being this contented monogamist to having been sealed to some, I think at this point, like 53 women or something like that. And talk about this particular moment, because this really, for you, and you write about in the book, kind of characterizes the change for Brigham Young.
Well, he had been warning the people as they were heading west that, you know, if you intend to come along, you had better toe the line. There'd better not be criminality, excessive frivolity even. And there certainly had better not be questions about his leadership. So he certainly gave people fair warning that, you know, this is more or less what they're signing up for if they chose to follow him across the plains and over the mountains. And then there's this time, as you mentioned, early in 1849, where he gets angry about frivolity among a group of young men. You know, they're carousing with young women. They're petty forms of criminality. And he warns them that they basically have two choices. They can either leave the territory or they can suffer the consequences. And he talks about individuals deserving to have their heads cut off. And there's this one very strange scene where there's a petty criminal named Ira West. Yeah. And there's all sorts of discussion about whether or not he should be killed. And Young brings him before
now,
the people.
Now, explain for what, John Turner, because he hasn't done much.
he apparently hasn't done much. The sources are a little bit limited and opaque. Seems like he was, you know, at some instances of petty theft, maybe a failure to pay debts. Young calls him a swindler.
Yeah.
Certainly nothing that, you know, by most standards one would think would warrant death. And, you know, at first there's a church council that decides to fine him $100 and I think excommunicate him. And Young is not satisfied with that outcome. He still thinks Ira West deserves to die. And he then organizes a very strange public auction where West is basically put up for purchase. Nobody wants to buy him. And his brother ends up taking him home. And there are further discussions about the fact that you know, West deserves to die. Brigham Young says, you know, you can bring him to me. I'll cut his head off. As it turns out, and I had not figured this out at the time that I wrote the book, as far as I could tell, West just disappeared from history. But it turns out he did leave the territory and eventually settled in Arizona. So he eventually took heed and cleared out. But it's, you know, chilling language and rhetoric that Brigham Young is willing to employ.
Well, he talks about the thing that that's interesting is he sort of speaks publicly about this. And if I understand it correctly, he essentially says to his people that it would be no sin to kill Ira West.
Right. Right. Which it just seems staggering that especially without, you know, some evidence to suggest much baser forms of criminality that Brigham Young would suggest this. You know, it's just at the time that the state of Deseret is being organized, and Brigham Young and others talk about the need to cleanse the platter, that they finally have the chance to establish a godly society based on divine law. And the sorts of things that might have been tolerated in Nauvoo are simply not going to be tolerated in Deseret.
In the Mormon community, there's been a lot of contention about this idea, the so-called concept of blood atonement. It's the idea that the only way really to atone for certain sins was to have your blood spilled, a blood penalty. And you are pretty straightforward about this idea. You say that Brigham Young forthrightly preached this doctrine. He talked about it, and not just as kind of hyperbole. You say he believed in it for some 10 years. He discussed it from time to time. He really believed it.
I think he did believe it. Partly because he does return to it on a number of occasions, this belief that there are some sins that are so grievous that Christ's blood will not atone for them, and that the only thing that can atone for them is the sinner's own blood. Despite that, I don't think there is clear evidence of any individuals being killed because of the teaching of blood atonement. I do think that Brigham Young condoned and even sanctioned some acts of violence. But the logic behind blood atonement was what you might consider a perverse form of theological charity.
Right.
And so I don't think anybody was being harmed out of a belief that it needed to be done in order to save their souls.
You say that he was suggesting that killing people before they had the opportunity to forsake their salvation, and here's that perverse sort of spin on the golden rule, is loving our neighbor as ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that preaching becomes very pronounced during what's called the Mormon Reformation.
Yeah.
In 1856 and 1857. At the same time, you know, it's hard to find instances in which this is really put into practice. There's a hint of it in one act of violence in 1856. For the most part,
well, wait, isn't a man castrated?
A man is castrated.
Yeah.
And Brigham Young suggests in a letter to that individual's mother that, you know, this might be for his own good, that it might, you know, that it needed to be done and that it might be for this individual's benefit. It's a very chilling episode. There are a lot of other instances when Brigham Young preaches this and people actually come forward and confess sins such as adultery and offer their heads in response to this preaching. And Brigham Young tends to say, you know, just don't commit that sin again. Keep your head.
So I guess that's the question. Was this just bluster? Because you say that he would use these violent threats to kind of terrify people.
Mm-hmm.
So was it just kind of rhetoric?
I think the preaching about blood atonement was mostly used to terrify people. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately the episode we talked about earlier, the Ira West episode, he mostly seems to be using that sort of violent rhetoric to terrify people. But there are instances in which he condones and sanctions acts of violence. I think a lot of the time it is rhetoric. But at the same time, I think to say that it's just rhetoric isn't sufficient. There's even something chilling about just using that sort of language to terrify people.
Yeah.
That shapes the culture of a place. And I think it certainly also led many other people within the church, some other local leaders, to think that violence might be something that would be condoned.
Well, which clearly leads, of course, to the Mountain Meadows Massacre. We talked about the Ira West story, how Young made this, not-so-veiled suggestion to the saints of, to actually go ahead and kill this man. Why wouldn't the same kind of thing apply to the story of Mountain Meadows?
Well, the preaching about blood atonement mostly seems to apply to members of the church who are falling away through sin or apostasy.
Right.
The Mountain Meadows Massacre is the slaughter of a non-Mormon wagon train that's passing through the Utah Territory in September of 1857. It happens during what's called the Utah War,
right,
when an American army is marching to the territory with Brigham Young's replacement. My understanding from my examination of the evidence is that local leaders in southern Utah are the ones who decided to massacre this wagon train. I think they would not have done so without Brigham Young's wartime strategy and policies that year. This wouldn't have happened in any other year in Utah's history.
It's funny. I have to say this conversation, goes on, and the question is whether was there some sort of smoking gun, some sort of direct piece of proof that suggests Brigham Young, made an order that made this happen. You certainly haven't found anything like that. But it sounds like what you're saying is in some way he was partly responsible just because of the sort of heightened rhetoric and the language and the atmosphere of the time. Is that fair to say?
I think so. I mean, some people perhaps would blame President Buchanan for sending the army to Utah in the first place.
Right.
And it is somewhat understandable that Brigham Young could see this approaching army as yet another anti-Mormon mob. But even so, I think a lot of Brigham Young's actions as governor toward U.S. officials had been very incendiary and provocative. And when he learns that the army is headed toward Utah, he mobilizes Utah's militia to defend the territory. He encourages Native Americans to fight on the side of the Mormons, encourages Indians to attack wagon trains. He instructs his people not to sell anything to the Gentiles, to non-Mormons passing through the territory. So he creates a very explosive situation. And this wagon train has a series of conflicts with Mormon settlements, particularly in Cedar City. I think it's also a prosperous wagon train. I think there's an element of greed involved in the attack as well. In the midst of the standoff, people in the South send a letter to Brigham Young for his advice, and his response really is twofold. Number one, you must not meddle with them. Let the emigrants go. But secondly, if the Indians want to attack them, that's fine. Don't stand in their way. So it's exculpatory in terms of Brigham Young specifically ordering the massacre, but it's also a bit incriminating in terms of encouraging an Indian attack.
You've also taken note of the fact that those who were possibly or probably responsible for those killings, many of them not only weren't punished, but they stayed in the good graces of Brigham Young.
That's absolutely correct. It's clear that at the very latest, by August of 1858, Brigham Young knows that John D. Lee and other Mormons were on the ground at Mountain Meadows. So he knows that at the very least, a number of his own people are responsible. Rumors do not keep to themselves in the Utah Territory. So I think he had pretty good sense of what had happened pretty quickly, even if he didn't know all the details. And nevertheless, there are no excommunications until 1870. There is what appears to be very half-hearted willingness to cooperate with any judicial investigation of Mountain Meadows. You know, I think for Brigham Young, he saw his first task as protecting the church and himself. Hmm. And he saw those two things as very much intertwined. And I think that he saw any investigation into Mountain Meadows as potentially very threatening to the church and himself.
John Turner is with us. His book is Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet. We are going to take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with historian John Turner. We're talking about his biography of Brigham Young. It's called Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet. You write about how Brigham Young had had the same advice in some ways for Gentile and Saint. Mind your own business, mm-hmm. which had multiple meanings. In one way, it was for the Saints. It was, you know, get to work. Don't be idle. But you say it also meant don't question my decisions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. He wanted church members to put their shoulders to the wheel and undertake his guidance, endure sacrifices that were required without questioning.
Your place, I guess.
Yeah, know their place. It was his role to lead, and it was their role to follow. And he would say that on a number of occasions. That phrase, mind your own business, was sometimes called the Mormon Creed back during these years.
Anybody dare challenge him? What was it like to go up against Brigham Young if you were a saint in those times?
Very unpleasant. Probably not for the weak of stomach. No, people sometimes did cross him. Orson Pratt was a brother of Parley Pratt and had a number of confrontations with Brigham Young. He opposes Young's decision to reconstitute a first presidency of the church in 1847, about 3 years after Young has become the de facto leader of the church. And Brigham Young tells him, you know, I am the head, you are the belly, you know, get in the harness. And Orson Pratt is one of the few who continue to resist. He has a streak of theological independence, and they have a number of clashes in the 1850s and 1860s. And Young does not keep his responses private. He will stand up in front of a congregation on Sunday and denounce Orson Pratt's vain philosophy and so forth. So if you wanted to disagree with Brigham Young, and especially if you persisted in those disagreements, he would call you out in front of everybody.
Mm. He had pretty salty language, and I'm wondering, was that typical, or was that just kind of the way he was?
I think it was atypical for a religious leader in 19th century America. It was not atypical for the Western frontier in the 19th century. It was not only confined to Brigham Young. You know, other church leaders were pretty salty as well, such as Heber Kimball. I often found those sorts of statements very humorous. You know, I mean, maybe some readers will be shocked by them, but through some of that salty language, you can get a, you can perceive a very raw and effective sense of humor. So I think sometimes when he's using that, especially in denouncing enemies of the church, it's also a form of entertainment for those that are listening to him.
Do you think you would have liked him? If you would have met him, would he have been kind of fearful, or would there have been some kind of wry sensibility about him that would have made him scary but kind of likable?
I think if you met him in a way that was not threatening to him, he would be very likable. So visitors from the East with whom he felt comfortable would find him very charming. They would sometimes describe him as a genial Yankee farmer. I don't think he would necessarily totally relax unless he knew people well. But he could be very sociable. This is a man who will, even when he's 60 years old, he'll dance late into the night with the people. You know, he dances in the Nauvoo Temple with people late at night. He's maybe not quite as sociable as Joseph Smith was, but he could enjoy those sorts of moments as well. So I think with Brigham Young, it'd probably be more of a mixed bag. If he felt threatened, he responded very, very sharply and very fiercely.
There's a great letter he writes to a young man who has asked Brigham Young to approve his divorce. And I'll clean this up a little bit, John Turner, because there is a curse word in here, although it's hard to replace the word with something proper. But Young writes this to the young man. He says, you took her, this woman, you took her for better or for worse. You had no right to ill-use her. And if she, I'll replace the word, pooped in the bed and laid in it until noon, you must bear it.
Well,
he used another word. He used the S word there. Yeah. But it's such a great piece of kind of admonition and really, really frank.
Well, and he was fairly liberal in granting divorces to women, especially plural wives, and especially if they were in abusive situations. He was much stricter with men. You know, he wasn't going to let him off the hook. Basically, the old "you made your bed, you better lie in it" sort of advice. But he could be extremely blunt, and I think sometimes that was rather effective.
Yeah. And his impressions in terms of his relationships with women, or his opinions about women. You say you know a lot of the times you could pull out quotes and figure he's either a misogynist or a proto-feminist, but as you put it in the book, neither portrait is accurate.
Yeah. Well, you're right in general about pulling quotes out of Brigham Young's many sermons. I mean, he spoke so often about so many topics that you can make him stand for nearly anything. But in terms of his views on women, he does seem to become a bit more open to women's ecclesiastical and intellectual talents as the decades pass. And so he comes to appreciate the leadership of women like Eliza Snow and Zina Huntington and the role of Relief Society over the last 10 or so years of his life in a way that he doesn't appreciate when he first becomes the leader of the church.
I think one of the big messages of the book is that from a man who was all in, as I've said, and so stolid and so uncompromising in many ways. You talk about in the book, in the end, when he had the opportunity, he didn't make kind of a Masada-like final stand. He does give way. He does find some flexibility.
Well, he will defend his position as long as it's practical.
Yeah.
So hold as much territory as he can for as long as he can. So stem the political and economic influence of non-Mormons in Utah for as long as he can,
right,
by whatever means. But yeah, he doesn't want to make a glorious last stand like the Alamo or like George Custer. He has no desire to go down in flames and see himself or his church destroyed. So when his back's against the wall, he'll make compromises that are necessary.
You write about how Young's relationship with his people really changes toward the end of his life. I mean, there are times, of course, when people truly did fear him. But you say toward the end of his life, he became seen by some as kind of more cantankerous than fearsome. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, I guess, they knew what to take and what to kind of put aside with Brigham Young.
Sure. And by the 1870s, he's had to make a lot of those political compromises with the U.S. government. And I think that removes some of his aura that he might have had in the 10 years after the arrival in the Salt Lake Valley. And, you know, it's in the 1870s that he tries very hard to push forward with the United Order, this plan for economic communitarianism and cooperation. And he meets with a lot of resistance. And I think at that point, a lot of church members have the sense that they can kind of ignore these instructions and that they're probably not going to persist after Brigham Young leaves the earth and leaves leadership of the church.
This is probably not a fair question with less than a minute left, but I was curious, what do you figure would have happened to Mormonism without a Brigham Young? I know it's kind of pointless to speculate, but do you ever wonder?
Well, in 1 minute, the church had a great deal of practical difficulties under Joseph Smith, a lot of dissent, a lot of collapse from within, and that doesn't happen under Brigham Young. He brags that the church doesn't endure 10% of the dissent under his leadership as it had under Joseph's. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. So he's responsible for increased cohesion and unity after 1844.
John Turner, his book is Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet. John Turner, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug. I enjoyed it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.